The Dolo White Podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. Follow Cinema Anywhere Nashville on Instagram and book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience today. Hey, it's Dolo White. This is the Dolo White Podcast. Real quick before we get started, I actually did it again. I said at the beginning of my interview with Dr. Cashin that this is episode 73. It's actually episode 74. I know you don't care. And again, I don't know why I'm like this, but I have to let you know. Having said that, my guest today is former White House staffer and author of the new book, White Space, Black Hood, Dr. Cheryl Cashin. In the book, she takes a deep dive on the racial disparities within housing in the United States of America. As you can guess, at every turn, no matter what the subject is, black and brown people get the short end of the stick, and there may be no other area more apparent than that than housing. So let's get this started. Welcome to the Dolo White Podcast.
Polo Gini. Live.
Yeah, what's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolo White Podcast.
Episode 73 now of the Dolo White Podcast. My guest today, super excited to have you on. Dr. Cheryl Cashin, you're a former White House staffer and the author of White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Thank you for being here.
So nice to be with you, Dolo White.
It's great to have you. We've covered this a lot on this podcast, especially being here in Nashville. I feel like I'm in the ballpark of what your book is about. Here in Nashville, back in, I want to say, the 60s and 70s, they put I-40 through a thriving black neighborhood. And it was North Nashville has not been the same since. And I know that's your field of expertise, correct?
Right. I basically write about the cumulative blunt force trauma visited on black neighborhoods, from redlining to Negro removal, urban renewal, to the interstate highways. Yes, they tended to be run through vital black neighborhoods, right? Separating the black and white side of town. That's what my book is about, and how we overinvest and exclude in affluent white space, and we disinvest, contain, and frankly, prey on people in majority black neighborhoods, prey on them with predatory loans, prey on them with policing.
I think that most people, when they hear terms like redlining and what we know now the government was doing to black neighborhoods back in the day, I think people think, well, that's over now. And one, I think that's a horrible way to think about it. One, because it still has an effect on that same neighborhood. What they did 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago still does have an effect. And two, they're still finding new inventive ways to disenfranchise specifically black and brown people.
Right. Okay. So there was redlining in the 30s, marking black neighbors as hazardous, cutting black people out of the largest wealth building program the federal government sponsored, federally insured mortgages. That manifests today in a wealth gap. For the average white person who has $1 of wealth, black people have 12 cents. But you fast forward today, the very same neighborhoods that were redlined in the 30s, a lot of them to this day, black people are discriminated against and cut out of traditional low interest affordable loans and have to go and like buy their houses on installment contracts, like buying them on layaway where they're don't even get equity if they until they finish the entire payment. You remember when you bought stuff on layaway? Right.
Yeah.
So you don't. And they're designed for the buyer to fail. Wall Street wants people who are buying on installment contracts to fail because then they can take their money and then flip the house and prey on someone else. So black people tend to be discriminated against. There's modern redlining, right? They can be as credit worthy as whites, but often won't get the same type of good terms that help promote success in home ownership. So the patterns of anti-blackness are still there.
And I think we see that a lot of times with appraisals. I've seen a couple things on social media where like a black person will get a bad appraisal and then have a white friend come and stand in for him, take all the pictures of themselves off the wall, and they get a better appraisal on that same piece of property.
Right. This is what the decision to redline in the 30s taught the lending industry and all insurers, all institutional actors, to devalue blackness to devalue Black homeowners. And those bad habits continue to this day. That's absolutely right. If you're going to get your home appraised, you have to like take away your Black art, take away pictures of your Black children. You know, it's sad, but I've heard so many stories like that where, okay, white in the house.
I remember growing up in the 80s in a white neighborhood. And it was if a Black person moved in, the property value was going to decrease. And I remember even being a kid, like, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand how that's even possible. I knew nothing about property values, but I just knew it just doesn't seem right.
It is not right. And we have to disrupt these ways of thinking. You know, Black people spend a lot of money on a lot of different things. And we are capable of paying our bills and keeping up our homes. But it's harder to do that when you're denied credit, you know, affordable credit, and given like products with usurious interest rates and things like that. But yeah, there still is this tipping point phenomenon where I don't remember what the threshold is. Maybe it's like 15% Black, something like that, where if a neighborhood gets to that point, then, you know, you start to get more white people moving out and changing perceptions. It's unfortunate.
It's weird. I grew up in Atlanta. I live in Nashville, Tennessee now. And I remember growing up in the Atlanta area, it was white flight. White people were moving out of the city and into the suburbs for racist reasons. And then it seems like it kind of flipped itself on its back, where white people are now trying to move into the city closer to the, and gentrification is happening now in both cities, Atlanta and Nashville.
Right. Now, I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, right? My parents are Fiskites and I went to Vanderbilt, right? Okay. So I'm familiar with Nashville. I'm familiar with Atlanta. Nashville. Familiar with Huntsville, right? But I'll say, yes, this is happening. And this is the real tragedy. The federal government, through redlining, devalued Black neighborhoods. And there's studies showing that 8-9 decades on, the decision to mark Black neighborhoods as hazardous correlates to disinvestment and decline. And the gentrifiers can go in and take advantage of that devalued Black neighborhood to buy low. And that's what gentrifiers are tending to do, because there's, you know, there's pressure on the housing market. So where is the value? It's in Black neighborhoods. And the gentrifier probably isn't having to deal with a predatory loan. They probably can get good traditional credit to snap up a devalued Black occupied home. This is the process. It's like I call in my book, Black Americans Descendants. It's a term of affection to show the correlation from slavery to Jim Crow to the residential caste to the Black ghetto, right? People trapped in it. But it's like descendants can't win.
No, it seems like no matter how much we uncover from the past, we never take steps to make it right for the future. We're just like, well, that happened. That shouldn't happen. Sorry about that.
Well, let me say this. I'm going to defend the Biden administration.
Okay. Right?
Joe Biden ran on a platform. He's the first Democratic president, maybe since LBJ, where he talked about racial equity. He talked about the Black-white wealth gap, right? And at least through executive action, he has, you know, put Susan Rice in charge of this, of trying to have a racial equity lens and how funds are allocated. You know, his transportation secretary, Pete Buttigieg, talks about that racial trauma of highways, right? And they are trying going forward to do things differently. I'm not up to date on, you know, what they're doing about fair credit, but it's not as if they aren't talking about these things. It matters who's in the White House. And I'm going to tell you, the previous occupant of the White House was doubling down on policies that segregated and devalued Black neighborhoods.
And we see that in Tennessee right now, I believe, with at least educationally, with the school voucher program, which I've talked about on this podcast before. And I like to get to schools because it feels like to me, if you really wanted to turn something around, what we know a better education leads to later in life, you would put more funding in schools, particularly in lower income neighborhoods. But that seems to be the opposite of what we do.
Right. That's what I talk about. So what I say in my book, White Space Black Hood, is that we have three current anti-Black processes going on. One is doubling down on segregation. The other is opportunity hoarding. And the third is stereotype-driven surveillance. We know about that. We know about all those videos of Black bodies being surveilled, right? But opportunity hoarding, we spend in this country $23 billion more annually in majority white school districts than in black and brown school districts, heavily black and brown school districts that educate the same number of children. $23 billion more. To educate the same children. So this country, what we do is we put our least experienced teachers and the least resources in the struggling high poverty schools. Our competitors in Western democracies do the opposite. They put extra resources and their more experienced teachers in disadvantaged areas to try to help them catch up. We call ourselves a land of opportunity and we do the opposite. That's why I argue that we have a system of residential caste where zip code really becomes destiny. What we do is in affluent white space, it's like riding the up escalator. All the systems work for you. You have great, well-resourced schools. You have golden infrastructure, which actually paid for by the gas tax dollars of the people who are excluded. But if you are in the hood, and I use that term with affection, it's like you're in a neighborhood that's designed for you to fail.
Yeah.
It's like riding the down escalator. And when we tell tales about the people in the hood to justify the way things are, and the biggest myth in this country is that high opportunity living is earned and hood living is the deserved result of bad individual choices. It's actually the result of a century of anti-Black systemic processes that contain and disinvest. So I shine a light on it, but I don't think it's hopeless. I really don't. In progressive cities, there's a lot of awakening to the unfairness. And you know, I was just reading about Nashville before I came on the air with you about sort of these collective learning processes they're going through where they're sort of looking at this history of redlining and you know, highways and things and thinking about collectively, how can we have a fairer distribution of resources and how can we deal with the home ownership gap and Black families that have been harmed?
We have great leadership that is outside of government here in Nashville that's pushing for a lot of progressive things. My guy, Jamil Campbell-Gooch at the Black Nashville Assembly, Rashida Fatuga at Gideon's Army, they do amazing work just right there in the community. Mm-hmm. And they push, they find out what people's wants and needs are, and then they push for those with the government. And it's win some, lose some, but everything they say makes so much sense. It's like, why aren't we doing anything? Why do we just sit here and continue to do the same thing, what feels like the same thing over and over and over again? So that's my question to you. Why do we keep going in the circle?
Well, to give your listeners some hope, all right, I write for Politico magazine. There's no paywall. And I wrote a piece on MLK Day. If you Google Cheryl Cashin, MLK Day, Politico, I wrote a piece in which I featured progressive cities that were atoning for their racial systemic sins with concrete steps. For example, Bruce's Beach, you know, LA County, giving back land that was wrongfully taken from a Black family, right? Evanston, Illinois has a housing reparations program. With this whole history you've talked about redlining, et cetera, they basically will give you, if you can prove that you descend from a family that was redlined, you can get a $25,000, $35,000 grant as a down payment for a home, right? To buy a home or improve it. That's explicit reparations. A number of cities are changing their zoning laws to create a more of a variety of types of housing. Not everybody can afford a single family detached home. For some people, a duplex is a castle, a triplex, right? You know, well, an apartment. Right. An affordable apartment. Right. So I show some of that movement. Like, and then also things like just like making bus routes and transportation free from high poverty neighborhoods, progressive multiracial power that gets to 51% is doing something different. Peacemaker fellowships for the young guys who are caught up in gun violence, paying them for their expertise because they know better than anybody else who's pulling the trigger and how to reduce gun violence. So there's innovation there. You have to have organizations that are fighting to hold government accountable. And you also need to run for office and win elections.
Yeah, I was going to say Gideon's Army here in Nashville, in North Nashville, which, by the way, 37208, the zip code, North Nashville zip code, at one time, I don't know if it still is, but it has been the highest incarceration rate of any zip code in the United States of America. What Gideon's Army does is they actually have a team of what they call violence interrupters, who were former street guys who go in and they try to dissolve violent situations peacefully. And they're trying to get funding from the city now. You know what I mean? And we should totally fund that, because that is something Absolutely. That needs to be done.
There, you know, this is a movement. There are about 20 cities. I write about this in the MLK piece, right? Yeah. You cannot police your way out of the situation we're in. And there's a place, a website called Advance Peace, where they list the cities that are doing exactly this. So yes, Nashville should be paying for that. For a fraction of the cost of policing, you can get some serious results with this.
Yeah, and I think that we have to think about this new, like, this more jails, more officers, more guards is not the answer to a country where we're supposed to be the greatest country in the world, but we lock up more than anybody else on the planet. Right. And that's insane.
Right.
How do you say you're the greatest country in the world and, you know, you have the largest population of inmates? That's not a good thing. It's not a bragging point.
It's also very expensive.
Yes.
Right? It's cost a lot. I have this devastating stat in Chicago. The city and state of Chicago spend $1 million per any city block to incarcerate people. And they have 851 blocks where they're doing this. So every 4 years, they spend $851 million to incarcerate people on these inner city blocks, nearly $1 billion every 4 years. But, you know, I cite these programs that they reduce gun violence just by giving in some of these high poverty neighborhoods, just by giving every kid a summer job. Mm. Or doing this violence interrupters. City of Richmond, California did that kind of program. The Peacemaker Fellowships with a $1 million grant. Gun violence fell by 55%
over
5 years. So my plea is in my book is that if you can change the lens that you apply to Black people from presumed thug to presumed citizen, see Black people as three-dimensional human beings worthy of the moniker citizen, worthy of, and see them as assets who can transform themselves, their neighborhoods, if given a chance. If you apply that lens, frankly, a lens of care and love, which I was taught to apply to all my people, it frees you up to focus on evidence-based strategies like this peacemaker, violence disruption that puts you in a more virtuous cycle of repair rather than harm. Incarceration, you know, it just takes a person out of the community. That's somebody's brother, father. Right.
I think it starts kind of piggybacking off what you just said is really looking at people as human, because I think when we use terms like criminal, thug,
right,
you're dehumanizing a person. And
that dehumanization has driven public policy for decades. I have a chapter called Ghetto Mythology that says it. And the words, we know them: welfare queen, thug, super predator. Right. That word super predator was so central, you know, during the Clinton years to, you know, a crime bill that just, you know, and the war on drugs, you know. So the labels we use and the stories we tell drive policy. So I'm really trying hard to put out a different narrative.
If it were up to you, what would be the first step? What does step one look like in resolution? Okay.
So step one is truly, you know, let's change the lens and see all people in the city as citizens and assets and potential change agents, right? There, people are very knowledgeable about their neighborhoods and what they need in their neighborhoods. Like you said, how about asking people what needs to happen in this neighborhood to make it better? I feature in my final chapter a citizens budgeting process in Milwaukee where the citizens engaged and were horrified to learn that half the city budget was going to policing, right? And they identified priorities in their neighborhood. And it wasn't earth shattering, but, you know, it made sense. Youth jobs, summer jobs for youth, more affordable housing, and something better than, you know, inhumane policing. So the first is the lens. But the second, my biggest priority is, the historically defunded, historically redlined Black neighborhoods. They should be first in line. So racial equity in public and private investment. They should be first in line for the new infrastructure dollars. And there is a number of cities have adopted a formal racial equity process where they have to. You just said a zip code, right? I don't know all the zip codes, but so the zip codes that have not been getting their fair share of basic resources, you know, there needs to be an overt effort to give them more. So that's my first strategy. My second, you know, it's kind of wonkish. Inside the Beltway Washington term, but inclusionary zone, mandating that every neighborhood have its fair share affordable housing so more people can grab onto the dream, you know, of living near and in high opportunity.
What's the point of being the richest, most powerful country in the world if people are still starving to death and living in subpar housing, right? Like, what's the point? Why are we doing this? Why are we huffing our chest out?
Absolutely. And my message is to all audiences, it's not just people trapped in the hood that are harmed this way. We're not creating, we're only creating an opportunity, serious opportunity for the people who can afford to buy their way into these golden standard neighborhoods. And everybody else is getting much less than they need or deserve.
Dr. Cheryl Cashin, the book is White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding, and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Thank you so much for doing this. You're a wealth of knowledge. I would love to have you back anytime.
Anytime, Dollar White. I enjoyed it.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. You can book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience right now, starting at only $350. Cinema Anywhere Nashville provides your choice of a 16, 24, 36, or even 100-foot screen, plus projector setup and sound system. This is a super dope service that wouldn't just be great for corporate and work events, but also birthday and holiday parties, or if you want to have a romantic evening with your significant other, Cinema Anywhere Nashville is perfect for all of those things. They have the right experience for you. Follow them on Instagram right now at Cinema Anywhere Nashville and book your cinema experience today. I want to say thank you once again to my guest, Dr. Cheryl Cashin. She's amazing. She's a wealth of knowledge, and you should definitely check out her book, White Space, Black Hood, and follow her on Instagram as well at Cheryl.Cashin. Follow me as well at DolaWhite101, DoleWhite101. Definitely appreciate you checking out the podcast. No matter what platform you're listening on right now, make sure you subscribe and follow and rate and review if they let you rate and review, only if you're going to say nice things. Again, if you have bad things to say, you can always DM me. You don't have to say that in a public space. Back next week with a brand new episode. Going to talk about how to get noticed on LinkedIn with Jeremy Schiefling. Super dope episode drops first thing Wednesday morning next week. Until then, I'm out. Appreciate you checking out the podcast.